"Gladly would I," Joseph replied, "and would cross the threshold and visit you. But there are many things here in the hall to attend to, and much still to arrange which needs me to cast my eye." But the voice sounded again, "Come in to me. The mistress commands it." And Joseph crossed the threshold and went in to her. The Father's Face. Here our story loses its tongue. I mean our present version and repetition in the feast does so. For in the original, as it happened and told itself, it by no means lost its tongue. It went on, there in the twilit room, in an agitated exchange, a dialogue in the sense that both parties talked at once. I prefer, however, to draw over the scene the veil of delicacy and human feeling. For in that long-ago time, it went on without witnesses, whereas here and today it is performed before a large audience. A decisive difference, as no one can deny, where a question of tact is involved. Joseph particularly was not silent. He could not be silent, but talked very volubly, almost breathlessly, bringing to bear all his wit and charm against the woman's desire, in the attempt to talk her out of it. But just here lies the reason why our story loses its tongue. For he became involved in a contradiction, or rather, a contradiction presented itself, as he talked, most painfully affecting and troubling to human feeling. The contradiction between body and soul. Yes, as the woman, in words or by her silence, answered to what he said, his flesh stood up against his spirit, and in the midst of his most fluent and eloquent speech, he became an ass. And what a shattering contradiction that is! What restraint it demands from the narrator, when eloquent wisdom is given the lie by the flesh, and is manifest an ass. He fled, for we know that he succeeded in flying, in the state and condition of the dead god. To the woman, an aggravated occasion for despair and the raging fury of frustration. Her desire had discovered in him a manly readiness, and the forsaken woman alternately tore at and caressed the garment which he left in her hands, for we know that he left his garment behind him, in paroxysms of frantic agony, with loud outcries of exultation and anguish. The Egyptian woman's cry, repeated over and over again, was, "Me'eni nachtef, I have seen his strength." Something enabled Joseph in that uttermost extremity to tear himself away and flee. That something was his father's face. He saw his father's face. All the more detailed versions say so, and we may take it for the truth. It is so, when, despite all his skill of tongues, he was almost lost, the face of his father appeared to him. Jacob's image? Yes, certainly Jacob's image. Not an image of settled and personal lineaments, which he saw somewhere in the room. Rather, he saw it in his mind, and with his mind's eye. An image of memory and admonition. The father's in a broad and general sense. For in it, Jacob's features mingled with Potiphar's fatherly traits. There was something of the modest departed Montcalm, and over and above all these were other mightier traits. Out of bright brown father eyes, with soft tear sacks beneath them, it peered at Joseph in tender concern. This it was which saved him. Or rather, he saved himself. For I would speak in the light of reason and give credit where it is due, not to any spirit manifestation. He saved himself in that his spirit evoked the warning image. In a situation only to be described as far gone, with defeat very nigh, he tore himself away, to the woman's intolerable anguish, as we must, in justly divided sympathy, admit, and it was fortunate that his physical agility equaled his glibness of speech, for he was able, 1, 2, 3, to twist himself out of his jacket, the garment, his outer raiment, at which she clutched in the abandon of her love, and to escape, in not very steward-like array, to the hall, the banqueting room, the vestibule. Behind him, in her thwarted love, she raved, half in raptures, "Me'eni nachtef," but yet betrayed beyond bearing. She did frightful things with the garment still warm with his body, which she held in her hands, the precious, hated object. covered it with kisses, drenched it with tears, tore it with her teeth, trod it underfoot, dealt with it, in short, much as the brethren had dealt with the veil of the sun at Dothan in the vale. "Beloved," she cried, "whither do you go from me? Stay, O blissful boy, O shameless slave! Curses upon you! Death, treachery, violence! Seize the miscreant! He has slain my honor! Help, help, help for the mistress! A fiend has attacked me!" There we have it. Her thoughts, if we may speak of thoughts, where there was nothing but a whirlwind of rage and tears, had brought her to the accusation with which she had more than once threatened Joseph in the fury of her desire, when she raised her lioness claws against him. The murderous accusation that he had monstrously forgotten himself toward her, his mistress. The wild recollection rose in the woman's mind. She flung herself on it, shrieked it with all her strength, as one hopes by sheer voice power to lend truth to the untrue, and our justifiable sympathy must make us rejoice that the insulted woman found this outlet to her anguish, that she could give it an expression, false of course, yet matching it in horror, which was calculated to inflame all who heard, turn them into allies of her insulted state, and make them pant to avenge it. Her yells resounded. There were already people in the vestibule. The sun was setting, and most of Petipre's household had returned to house and courtyard, so it was good that the fugitive had a little time and space to collect himself before he emerged. The servants stood rooted to the ground with horror, hearing their mistress's cries, and though the young steward came at a measured pace out of the banqueting hall, and passed with composed mien among them, it was as good as impossible not to connect the impaired state of his clothing with the shrieks that issued from the inner room. Joseph would have liked to gain his room, the special room of trust, to put himself to rights, but as there were servants in the way, and a craving to get out of doors took the upper hand, he crossed over to and through the open bronze door to the courtyard, which was full of the bustle of homecoming. Several litters were drawing up before the harem, containing the secondary wives. The chattering little creatures, under supervision of Nubian eunuchs and scribes of the House of the Secluded, had been vouchsafed their glimpse of the feast, and were now being returned to their gilded cage. Whither should the fugitive flee with his black eye? Out through the gateway by which he once had entered? And thence? That he himself did not know, and was glad that he still had space before him in the courtyard, and might move as though he were bound somewhither. Then he felt his clothing twitched, and Bess Emheb, the little dwarf, piped up at him, his face all crumpled with his grief. "Ravaged the field, burnt by the bull. Oh, ashes, ashes! Oh, Sarsif, oh, Sarsif!" They stood halfway between the main house and the gateway in the outer wall. Joseph turned, the little man hanging to him. The sound of the woman's voice came over to him, the voice of the mistress. The white figure stood at the top of the house steps, surrounded by a crowd which poured after her out of the hall. She stretched out her arm, and men followed it, running, with arms likewise outstretched in his direction. They seized him, and brought him back among the courtyard folk, running up before the house. Gate and doorkeepers, artisans, stablemen, gardeners, cooks, and silver-aproned waiters. The weeping midget clung to his skirt and was borne along too. And Potiphar's wife addressed to her husband's servants thus gathered before and behind her in the courtyard that well-known speech which at all times has been counted against her by all men, which even I, despite all I have done for Mut-Im-Enet's saga and her cause, cannot fail to condemn. Not on account of its untruth, which might pass as the garment of the truth, but on account of the demagogy which she did not scorn to use to rouse the people. "Egyptians," she cried, "children of Kempt, sons of the river and the black earth." What did she mean by that? They were just ordinary people, and at the time nearly all of them a little drunk. Their Egyptian birth as children of Hapi, insofar as it was a fact, for there were among them Moors from Cush, and people with Chaldean names, was a native merit. They had nothing to do with it, nor did it help them in the least if they neglected their duties, for their backs were bruised with thick leather straps well laid on, regardless of whose children they were. And now, all at once, their birth, which had been very much in the background and had no practical value for the individual, was brought to their notice with flattering emphasis, because it could be used to rouse their sense of honor, unite them in a common pride, and make them pant with fury against someone who had to be destroyed. Her challenge bewildered them, yet it had its effect, combined with that of the good barley beer. Egyptian brothers! They were her brothers all at once. It went through and through them. They found it thrilling. Behold me, your mistress and mother, Petipre's chief and true wife. See me as I sit upon the threshold of this house. We know each other well, you and I. We and each other. They swallowed it down. This was a good day for the lower classes. But likewise know you this Hebrew youth, standing here half-naked on this great day in the calendar, lacking his upper garment, because I have it in my hands. Do you recognize him who was set a steward above the children of the land and over the house of one great in the two lands? He came down out of his wretched country to Egypt, Osiris's beautiful garden, the throne of Re, the horizon of the good spirit. They brought this stranger to us, into this house. Us, again, to mock us and bring shame upon us, for this frightful thing has happened. I sat alone in my chamber, alone in the house, for I was unwell and was dispensed from appearing before Amun and kept the empty house alone. Then the abandoned one, the Hebrew fiend, took advantage of my being alone and came in unto me that he might do his will with me and bring me to shame. The servant would lie with the mistress, she screamed the words. Lie with me to enforce me. But I cried with a loud voice when he would have done it, and have shamed you for his servant lust. I ask you, Egyptian brothers, have ye heard me cry out with all my strength, in evidence that I repulsed him and defended myself to the utmost as the law demands? Ye have heard it. But when he too heard it, the abandoned one, that I lifted up my voice and cried, then his boldness failed him, and he struggled out of his outer garment, which I have here as evidence, and would hold him by it, that ye might seize him, and fled away from me with his evil purpose unaccomplished, and got him out, so that I stand here pure before you, thanks to my outcry. But he, who was set over you all and over this house, he stands there in his shame, who will be seized of his deed, and judgment shall come upon him as soon as the master, my husband, comes home. Put the clog on him. This was moot speech. It was not only untruthful, but provocative, and Potiphar's household stood there stupefied and helpless. They had already been not too clear-headed, with all the free temple beer they had had, and now they were completely dazed. They had heard, all of them, that the mistress was infatuated with the handsome young steward, and he denied her. And now, suddenly, it turned out that he had laid hands on the mistress and tried to do her violence. It made their heads go round, what with the beer and what with the mistress's tale. They could not make it rhyme, and all of them were fond of the young steward. Certainly the mistress had cried out, they had all heard her, and they knew the law. It was evidence of a woman's innocence if she cried out when she was attacked. And she had the steward's garment in her hands. It really looked as though she held it as a forfeit when he tore himself away. But he himself stood there with his head sunk on his chest and said not a word. Why are you hesitating? They heard a strong, manly voice saying, the voice of Dudu, the gentleman dwarf, who stood among them in a stiffly starched feast-day skirt. Do you not hear the mistress? That she has been so cruelly insulted and nearly brought to shame, and she commands that the clog be brought and laid upon the Hebrew slave? Here it is. I have brought it with me. But when I heard her lawful outcry, I knew where we were and at what o'clock, and quickly fetched the tools out of the whipping room to have them at hand. Here they are. Stop gaping and fetter his lustful hands. Bind up this infamous slave, bought long ago on the advice of the shallow against that of the sound. For long enough has he played the master and been set over us who are true-born. By the obelisk,
he shall be brought to the house of retribution and death.
It was Dudu's great hour, and he savored it to the full. And two of the servants took the clog out of his hand and put it on, while little Shepsis Bess whimpered in a way that made the rest of the crowd titter. It was a spindle-shaped block of wood with a slit in it, which could open and shut, holding the culprit's hands helplessly in the narrow hole, weighted down by the heavy wood.
"Fling him in the kennel," commanded Moot, with a frightful sob.
Then she crouched on the step where she was, in front of the open door, and laid Joseph's garment down beside her.
"Here I will sit,"
she said in her chanting voice that rang across the darkening courtyard, "on the threshold of this house, with the accusing garment by my side.
Withdraw from me, all of you, and let no one advise me to go in, that I suffer no harm from my thin garb in the cool of the evening. I shall be deaf to such pleas, for here will I sit beside my forfeit until Petipre drives in, and I receive atonement for my monstrous wrong."